Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. It's a little overcast today, but with that long string of warm, sunny days behind us, it sure feels like summer. In fact, it's a bit too warm to be planting vegetables that prefer cool weather, things like lettuce, kale, and broccoli. Yet, the summer solstice is officially still weeks away, and that means there are plenty of gardening days left on the calendar. So if you're a little late putting your green thumb to work this year, but still have hope, you'll find this hour helpful. Our guest today will tell us what we should be putting in the ground right now and how we can care for those plants to boost our chances of a good yield. And if you're already in the thick of managing your vegetable garden, maybe you have questions for our master gardener. What's the best way to get rid of slugs? Are coffee grounds and eggshells really good for your soil? What can you grow in a container and what can't you? We'll be taking your calls at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, and emails at midday@wypr.org. An expert here with me in the studio to answer gardening questions is Erin Melantine. She's Master Gardener Coordinator at the University of Maryland Extension. She has a background in soil science, and she has experience working on an organic vegetable farm. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you are with us. You know, some of our listeners are urban gardeners. Do you have any special recommendations for them as somebody with a background in soil science?
Absolutely. Urban gardening and urban agriculture is such a blossoming and booming sort of movement at this time. And it's wonderful. There's absolutely ways to be growing vegetables and fruits in your backyard if you live in a row home, in containers, on your patio, in many different facets. Something to be very considerate about and conscious of when you're planting in the urban environment, lead and heavy metal contaminants are certainly something to be aware of.
And so what does that mean, to be aware of lead?
That means that a lot of, before 1979, I believe that all of the paint that was used in a lot of housing projects contain lead in it. And so that can wash off down into the soil, and it will remain there in the upper 2 inches of soil, not really moving, but staying there in your backyard or your front yard.
It just stays there as long as that soil is mm-hmm. in place. Mm-hmm. And so it's mostly lead from paint that we're encountering in our yards?
A lot of it is lead from paint. Depending on where you live, you can do a search on the history of land use. And it can also be contaminants, heavy metal contaminants from industry that had possibly been where you are in the past.
Well, how about, I mean, there used to be lead in gasoline. So did car emissions filter down onto people's
correct.
Yards?
Yeah. So before there was the regulation that said you can no longer have lead in gasoline, when that fuel would burn through the car, you know, there would be deposition of lead, you know, onto the ground and then into the soil from exhaust emissions as well. You're correct.
So first of all, is there a lot of variation from place to place in the city?
Absolutely. Yeah, we highly recommend anyone looking to put vegetables or anything really in the ground itself to get a soil test done first.
What's involved in getting a soil test?
So you can get special bags either from the University of Maryland Extension, or you can just use a plastic Ziploc bag. And you're going to go around with a little trowel and take a soil sample that's at least 6 inches deep from the area that you are hoping to plant. You're going to mix all of that together, and you're going to send it out to a soil testing laboratory.
Let me interrupt and ask you. This is a lawn garden, not very big, but still, do I want to mix up the sample I take from this spot with the sample I take 4 feet away? Or do I want to keep them separate?
That's a very good question. I think what is typically recommended is that you are doing it by plot. So if you're going to have, you know, several 4x4 foot plots in your backyard, each different garden plot, you should take a separate sample from.
So you'll know when you get the results what that particular plot is like. So anyway, I interrupted you. You put this in a bag, either one bag or multiple bags if you want multiple test results, and then what?
And then you send it off to a soil testing laboratory. There are several in the area. The University of Maryland no longer has a functioning soil lab, but the University of Delaware does, a couple up in Pennsylvania. There are some private labs. Online, the University of Maryland Extension has a whole list of soil testing laboratories that are currently functioning and where you can send and you pay a small fee in order to get your results back.
By small fee, you mean what kind of fee? What's the range?
So anywhere between $7 to $20 is the typical range.
Okay. And how long does it take?
Anywhere from two days to 2 weeks.
Okay.
Depends on the lab and depends on how many samples, you know, they've kind of had sent in, you know, how backed up they may or may not be.
So if I get back word that there's lead in my land, what do I do?
Well, fear not. You can still garden. What you want to do, though, is preferably build what's called a raised bed garden. So that would include putting all of, you know, some 2x4s or 2x6s down and creating essentially a box on top of the ground. There are various fields of thought about whether or not you should put landscape fabric down as a barrier between your soil and then the topsoil that you will have brought in. But essentially, you're building a garden on top of the soil that's already there.
And you want this garden that you're building atop your land, you want this to be deep enough so that the roots of your of what you want to grow will never go into the soil with the lead in it. They will only go into this new soil that you're going to create.
Yeah, so you want to make the soil on top about 8 to 12 inches deep.
Okay. We already have some callers. Mike has called us from Baltimore. Mike, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks. I'm involved in a couple of garden projects. One is Roots and Branches Charter School. We do a community garden there. And lately, we just started a garden at St. Pius Catholic Montessori School out in Towson. And so we built 8 beds, 4x8 feet long, and they're about 10-inch high boards. And we have some clay soil, it seemed like, we got put in, and I'm having to supplement. I just went out today and got 12 bags of leaf grow. So I'm sort of wondering, the soil seemed a bit like too thick, and it needs to have some looseness added to it. So I'm going to add this leaf grow. So I'm just wondering how many bags maybe I should add to each of the beds, just what we should do. And also, it seems to be very hot now, and we're wondering what vegetables to put in, or just put anything in there just to get it started, because we got a late start this year because the grant came in late. So we're dealing with these exact issues that your guest is speaking about.
Okay, Mike, thanks for all of those questions. What advice would you have for Mike, Aaron?
So one thing that you do need to be conscious of when you are building raised beds and bringing that topsoil in, it's always really good to know where that topsoil is coming from, right? You want to make sure that you're not getting topsoil that, you know, is poor quality or perhaps was also, you know, excavated from a different contaminated site. So knowing, you know, that source of topsoil coming in is always really important. As far as, you know, having really clayey soil, what the recommendation always is to add organic matter. And so that leaf grow, that's a good source of organic matter. Mixing that in, either, you know, using a shovel and double digging it in, you know, or if you have a small little rototiller that you can, you know, use to incorporate that in your raised bed.
You and Mike are talking about something called leaf grow. What is leaf grow?
Leaf grow is essentially all of the leaves that had fallen off the trees and then had been composted. So it turns into this dark, rich, fibrous, you know, sort of beautiful, black, rich material that you can add into the soil that will break down and add nutrients.
And if you didn't do it yourself last fall with your leaves, you can buy it?
Yes, you can buy it at many different home and garden stores and centers.
So I think one of Mike's questions was kind of how much of that to use with soil that's pretty heavily clay.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you can estimate maybe about a quarter of that volume and trying to incorporate that into the top or adding, you know, about 1 inch to the top layer of every bed and incorporating that in. That's what my recommendation would be for this year. And you can continuously do that year after year. You know, one of the benefits of taking care of your soil first, since the soil is really what's nourishing the plant, is that you can improve your soil quality year after year.
You keep building on that.
You keep building on it, absolutely.
Mike, also question, with the temperatures we're having now, whether it's too... Mike, I'm not sure I remember exactly your concern about the temperatures.
Yes, just like lettuce, we have some lettuce and kale we were going to add to the garden, and just wondering whether we should hold off putting it in or put it somewhere else, or when it gets exposed to so much
sun. You think it's going to get cooler, Mike?
Well, it's seeming to be pretty hot so far.
Okay, let's see what Aaron Melantine has to say about that.
Absolutely. So you have essentially three growing periods, right? You have the spring growing period for those cooler weather crops like the kale and broccoli and cabbage and all of that sort of, you know, spring and fall crops. So you could plant those twice a year, essentially. And then now we're really moving into the summer season. And so I would recommend that you think about planting things like cucumbers and summer squash, zucchini. You can plant tomato seedlings. You know, if you actually buy the seedlings, that would be better at this point. And peppers, things like that. You know, working with the sort of weather that you have, because absolutely, you know, as you know, you can't make it any cooler.
Right. And when you say working with the weather, what can you, I mean, you just enunciated for some crops that would have a better chance, but you can't change the weather, but are there some ways to protect your newly planted plants from it?
Sure. Well, you want to make sure that if you are planting tomatoes, let's say, let's use tomatoes as the example, you want to make sure that they have been hardened off, which is the process of taking, you know, a transplant, a seedling that's already maybe about a foot tall, and bringing it outside gradually. If you take something that has been, you know, mostly under shade or inside, fairly protected from the wind in a much more controlled temperature environment, and just stick it out into full sun, it is probably going to be very unhappy. It could get sunburned, because plants do get sunburned. It could, you know, start having some strange growth because of wind or stunted growth. And so you really want to make sure that they get this kind of gradual transition from that inside nice growing environment, greenhouse, to the outside world. And that's one way to help your plants when you're going into that summer sort of season.
Mike, thanks for the call. Aaron, I'd like people to understand, you are the Master Gardener Coordinator. What do you coordinate exactly?
That's a wonderful question. So I work with the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City. There are other offices in counties around the state of Maryland, and in fact, other offices nationwide that are part of the Cooperative Extension. And nationwide, there's a program that is the Master Gardener Program. In the state of Maryland, every county and then Baltimore City has a Master Gardener Program. And if you are interested in gardening and want to help spread different and the most recent, up-to-date, scientific-based practices of growing and of horticulture, you can decide to become a volunteer educator with the Master Gardener Program. So you have a 12-week training session in the city that starts in January and goes through April, and you learn all of the basics. You learn the science behind the botany and disease and pest control. You learn about soil. You learn about the ecology of plants. And really just kind of this really comprehensive and basic introduction to horticulture and how to go out into the community and speak at events, put on workshops, you know, for...
And are there a lot of such events and workshops where master gardeners are asked to share what they know?
Absolutely. Yeah. We are at the Waverly Farmers Market and the JFX Farmers Market every weekend with a Ask a Master Gardener table. If you have questions, you can show up there and talk to a master gardener, and they can help you diagnose problems that you may be having or answer questions about what to put in the ground, you know, whether that's soil amendments or plantings.
So that's pretty much what we're doing this hour also. We are taking your questions and emails about gardening here on Midday on WYPR with Erin Melantine. She's the Master Gardener Coordinator at the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City. You can join this conversation. Is there a gardening problem that's plaguing you? Would you like to share it and maybe get some answers to it? You can join our conversation by calling us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this hour about gardening, particularly growing vegetables and amending your soil. We're talking about soil. We're talking about pests. Erin Melantine, the Master Gardener Coordinator at University of Maryland Extension, is here with me in studio. What gardening tips would you like to share? Have you hit upon some techniques that work really well for you that you'd like other gardeners to know about? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Christine has phoned us from Tillman Island. Christine, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you just fine. What's on your
great.
Mind?
First, I'd just like to say we moved down to Maryland from New York about a year ago, and the University of Maryland Extension website is just such a tremendous resource for us. We're beginning gardeners, so we really just love that website. But my question was, one of our neighbors gave us a lovely gift of 2 blueberry bushes, and we are just wondering, can we plant them in large containers, like 2-foot containers, or do they have to go in the ground? And then also, in terms of the soil, we understand that they prefer acidic soil, so we were wondering how much peat moss to soil, you know, ratio we should think about using.
Christine, thanks for those questions. Erin Melantine, what would you tell Christine about her blueberry bushes?
I think that if you have smaller blueberry bushes for now, planting them in containers would be all right. You know, blueberries frequently prefer slightly cooler soil temperatures too, and I think in a container you would find that the soil is going to warm up a lot faster than if it is in the ground. So it might not be a permanent home for them. As far as the soil acidity, what you really should do is check out your soil first and foremost and get a soil test. The soil test just doesn't tell you about whether there's lead and heavy metal contaminants. It will also tell you the soil pH. It will tell you available nutrients in the soil and will really help you assess what is already there and if you even need to add soil amendments to change anything.
And what if, I mean, okay, so we're back to getting a soil test, Christine, but what would these blueberry bushes need to thrive? I realize what gets added depends on what you find in the soil test, but what is the soil that Christine should be aiming for in those containers?
That's a really great question. So we're talking about blueberry bushes here, and they prefer acidic soil. And I believe that the range that blueberries prefer is about 6 to 6.5, lower.
Let me pull in. We've been joined by Baltimore City Master Gardener Patricia Foster, who was stuck behind an accident on the JFX.
I understand.
I'm glad you have been able to join us. And would you jump in exactly with that question? What we have Christine calling us from Tillman Island, who has some blueberry bushes that she intends to put in a planting container. We talked about whether that would be a long-term answer or not. But Christine also wanted to know what kind of soil.
Well, the soil is generally, you know, the classic is always loamy, well-drained, that kind of thing. But they do, as Erin said, require a low pH in the soil. It's easier if you're doing it in a container, actually, because you can control just that area that the blueberry bush is growing in. And really, they like it below 6. So somewhere between 5.6 and 5.8, The pH is very acidic.
Which is very acidic.
Yeah. Well, for most plants. Most plants can't take that low pH.
Christine, thank you. Thank you for the call. Patricia Foster, what vegetables do you recommend for a beginning gardener?
Well, I think the simplest ones are probably cucumbers. If you're growing depending on where you're going to grow, if you're going to grow in a bed, then you can branch out a little bit for crops. Certainly, beans are easy to grow. They require a little more work because you have to harvest them throughout their growing time. But lettuces are easy.
Really, lettuces seem, I would think they would be fragile and kind of temperamental.
Once they get going, they're pretty good. Huh. You know, they're pretty hardy, actually. The problem is that at this point in time, it's a little late to be direct sowing seeds.
I was just about to ask you,
given
where we are in the season,
what they don't care for. They prefer the cold, so they prefer to germinate in temperatures that are cooler, not hot.
And we're sort of past that.
Well, yes, instantly. Of course, it could frost tomorrow, the way weather has been, but you never know. But generally, lettuces, leafy greens, they're pretty easy. They don't require a lot of care. They're pretty disease resistant. So I think and it's small. So if you're talking city backyards, they don't take up a lot of space.
That is Baltimore City Master Gardener Patricia Foster here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Patricia Foster is also, I'm searching for my notes on you, your Master Gardener for the University of Maryland Extension's Baltimore City office and former president of the program and Executive Director of the Silburn Arboretum Association.
Correct.
All of that with Patricia Foster and Erin Melantine is here with me in the studio. She's the Master Gardener Coordinator at the University of Maryland Extension. You can be part of this conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. Dan has called us from Baltimore. Dan, welcome to Midday.
Hi there. How are y'all doing?
Just great. How are you
good.
Doing?
Doing well. I have a question. I've been working on my roof for the last probably 4 years out in Bolton Hill, and get a lot of sun up there. It's really hot, and I've started doing these kind of double bucket, self-watering bucket kind of things, and I'm just sort of wondering if either the Master Gardener or the Master Gardener Coordinator have any suggestions, knowing that I'm growing in these 5-gallon buckets, they're getting water mostly from underneath, and when I can bring a hose up there and I'm around, I try to do it every morning or every morning where it hasn't rained recently, give some water from the top. But what vegetables would be good? They're getting full sun, but it is hot up there. What are some precautions I could take that might help me grow some vegetables that don't quite like as much sun or as much heat?
Thank you, Dan. Who wants to answer?
He does want to wait. I don't think I understand the question. He wants plants that will thrive in that condition.
Yeah,
dry, hot.
I'm wondering
right?
what will thrive. Yeah, in that full heat and in the bucket.
Tomatoes.
Definitely tomatoes.
Yeah. Tomatoes will probably be dynamite because they can stand up to the heat. Cucumbers probably too. Anything that's kind of watery, like lettuces and spinach and chard, I'm not so sure. I think you might fry it up there. It'll steam for you naturally. But it's kind of hot. Tomatoes are really probably any kind of tropical sort of thing, because you're really almost mimicking
tropical temperatures. Nathan had called us with a question also about rooftop gardening. He was asking whether raised beds are possible on the rooftop. I assume he's not asking the engineering question of whether, you know, what kind of angle his roof has, but I think he's just asking whether that system can work up there on a roof.
I would definitely be cautious. I know we're not talking about the architecture here and whether or not the supports of the roof can handle that, but it will get very heavy. I have actually known several folks in the city who have tried to build raised beds on their roofs.
And again, it's very, very hot. So you need to make sure you have drainage on the bottom, whether that's some stone that's going to allow, you know, beneath the soil that you're putting up there, that's going to allow the water to actually travel out and through.
And then if you're talking stone, you're talking more weight.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, it's, I guess you would have to also accommodate, the soil. It wouldn't be the kind of soil you would do in a bed that was on the other soil, on the earth, but up there on the roof. Most roof gardens, green roofs, use a special soil, a growing medium that's not really soil, it's soil-less. I don't know how well vegetables would do in that situation. But
we have an email query about a roof situation also. Caleb writes us to say, I am growing plants on my roof porch. I want to put in a rain barrel and use the water for my container garden. I'm concerned about contaminants from the roof material. I think it's a tar roof. Also, my landlord wants to make the house cooler with a reflective silver roof paint. Should I be concerned about either of these leaching into the water that I'll use for plants?
Erin? I would say you should ask to see the ingredients of that silver reflective paint. That's one of the most proactive things you could do is look and see if there's anything that's alarming in there. Is it metallic? Is there potential for those contaminants to run off the roof after it's been painted? Because paint does chip and fleck. You know, that's something that's going to happen. If you are watering at the root zone, you know, and not watering, let's say you're growing leafy greens or something like that. If you're not pouring that water directly on your plant, that's okay for the most part.
Collecting it in a
in the rain barrel.
And the rain barrel is going to let some bad stuff settle out?
It's curious to me how he's going to collect it on top of a roof, because generally rain barrels are collecting runoff from a roof.
Yeah.
And then there are
that is what he plans to do and then haul the water back up to the roof.
Well, I don't know. That's a lot of schlepping, as they say. But I agree with Erin. I would definitely be cautious about that kind of rainwater. And the thing is, you can do is siphon off the first 2 minutes of the rainfall, and because that's when most of the contaminants are picked up by the rainwater going into the rain barrels. It collects.
So you're suggesting if you're home during the rainstorm, you can cover your rain barrel for the...
Well, no. You can just let it collect all that water and then, you know, dispose of the first...
The bottom. When you say first, you're talking about what has settled closer
to the bottom. Yeah, because that will be the water that is carrying the contaminants from the roof.
I want to assure listeners that we will get to back to tomatoes, because I think a lot of people really value tomatoes. But I want to take Sharon's call. Sharon is calling us from Owings Mills. Sharon, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I have a very happy, thriving herb garden in the front of my house. But one thing that's not thriving right now is my basil. I have some kind of bug that is eating it, eating holes in it, making it brown, and I've lost already 2 small basil plants. And I was wondering what I could do to address the bugs without putting an actual insecticide on it, because I'm doing purely organic gardening. I want my peas to stay healthy, you know, the peas in the area to stay healthy and come to my garden.
Sharon, I appreciate the question. Could you both hear Sharon's question? She's basically looking for an organic way to address whatever her basil's problem is.
Well, it's hard to diagnose it without seeing it. If there are, in fact, big chunks out of the leaves, my instincts would be slugs or some kind of caterpillar that's climbing up the stalk and munching on the leaves.
And so how would you address that?
Squish.
You just pick them off.
Mm-hmm. Pick them off.
Manually.
Yeah.
They like to hide on the underside of leaves, too, typically. So make sure that you're actually checking out the entire plant.
Yeah.
What would you suggest for squeamish gardeners who don't relish picking slugs up?
I don't like slugs either. But in fact, you can attract slugs away from your plants. But
how?
Well, first of all, this is an old time home remedy. If you have a charcoal grill and you have ashes from that grill, if you surround your plant, any plant, doesn't necessarily have to be vegetables, but slugs are famous for consuming hosta as well. If you surround that plant with a ring of charcoal ashes, they won't cross it because it hurts them. It hurts their underside trying to cross it, so they stay away.
So it's a physical barrier.
It's a physical barrier, correct. For squeamish gardeners, I don't know. You can take a little piece of paper and put it in a, you know, scoop them off into a jar.
Wear gloves.
Pick them off.
It's pretty clear to me that neither of our guests have much patience for squeamishness. I read about beer traps. I read about pouring some beer into a shallow
saucer
or the kind of plastic dish that a frozen meal comes in, entree comes in. Slugs have a tendency to go alcoholic?
They do. Well, supposedly they do, but I attended a lecture by one of the famous pest management guys at the University of Maryland, Mike Raup, who I'm sure he's probably been on this show at some point. He's an entomologist, and someone asked him in the class, what do you know about beer and slugs and how effective that is? And he said, I approve of beer and slugs as a method for getting rid of slugs. I generally tend to open the can of beer and have it myself and then go after the slugs with a knife.
Or maybe that would fortify people who are squeamish about picking the slugs up. What about insect pests? What kind of organic approaches or other approaches to dealing with insects?
Well, I don't know. You want to take this one? I'll chime in later.
Yeah. Again, there's a lot of manual labor involved quite frequently when choosing those organic approaches, right? And so picking and squishing really is one of the most popular ways to get rid of those pests. I've done that with the Mexican bean beetle and with the tomato hornworm, which are really large.
But they have a natural predator.
They do. They have a parasitic wasp that will take care of that. So there are other beneficial insects in your garden, too, that can help you take care of some of those problems, like ladybugs, for instance.
Ladybugs take care of what?
Aphids, pretty much.
And do those beneficial bugs tend to show up when you need them, or do you need to go and import them?
You know, they're there in the neighborhood generally, but and people do buy beneficial insects, especially like nematodes and things like that, mm-hmm. to get rid of certain pathogens, insects.
We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, we'll take more of your gardening questions. We'll talk about tomatoes and problems that they can have. And take your questions. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about vegetable gardening. I'm speaking with Baltimore City Master Gardener Patricia Foster and Erin Melantine, the Master Gardener Coordinator for the University of Maryland Extension. What is your biggest gardening challenge? Have you solved it, or are you still looking for answers? You can join our conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. We've gotten quite a few emails. By the way, Julie wants to tell us that she has a friend who's grown blueberry bushes in containers for years and they're doing fine. I just bought my first one. Living in the city, pots are the way to go. Do you tend to agree with our emailer?
I do. Because they need space, and it's so much easier in the city because pots are portable. So if they're not getting a lot of sun, you can move them to the place in your back garden that has sun.
And is there some rule of thumb that is there a mistake that you see gardeners making a lot with containers? Is there something? Is there some guidance that you think? I mean, do they tend to pick pots that are too small for what they're hoping to grow there, or does it work out pretty well?
I think it, for the most part, it works out well. I would say that one of the biggest hazards for gardeners is overwatering as opposed to underwatering.
For
anything in a container. I mean, a container generally requires more water than a plant that's planted in a bed, certainly. But you can drown them, and then that leads to root rot and that kind of thing. So you can do yourself, you know, do them in with kindness, or so you think.
Well, that sounds just like houseplants, the number of houseplants that I have killed from overwatering.
That's right.
A moment of silence. Megan has written us, "My fiancé and I have a small organic farm in northern Baltimore County. Our major problem is an invasion of thistle. Any pointers on how to deal with this problem?" Very glum expressions on our gardening experts here. Thistle.
Okay, farmer. Aaron was a former farmer.
That's right. I was, yeah, up at Moon Valley Farm in Baltimore County, up in Cockeysville. Luckily, we never had a thistle invasion. Thistle is not my favorite. I'm going to say that.
Canada thistle.
Yes. Yeah. The very prickly one. Really, try and chop it down and get it before it goes to seed. You know, if you're not into spraying of the pesticides and things like that, which I personally am not a huge advocate of, you know, to manually remove them and get them before they flower and go to seed is really the way that you got to tackle that.
Some people say that if you cut them down, don't try to dig it, because the network under the soil for thistle is just incredible. And it's impossible, really, to dig it. But if you cut them down, as you say, just when you see them, you'll eventually... the next year you'll have gotten rid of a third, and then the following year the next third, and it contains their growth, and it allows you not to have to use an herbicide, and still be in control of it. You know, a lot of gardening is in a process we call integrated pest management, or IPM, is what's your level of tolerance for a pest, you know, and weeds being a pest as well. You know, if you have to be totally weed free, you could probably be crazy in a year, trying to keep that down, especially this year when the weeds were just champions this year.
What was it about this year that
I think the cool, wet, I mean, did the cold, cold and the wet, cold and wet, and
weeds in general really like that.
Well, yeah, certain ones, because, and so with thistle, my advice is, cut it down. As soon as you see it, just keep cutting it back. Don't let it flower, because then you remove the mechanism by which it grows.
And that actually will then reduce the root structure.
Supposedly, yes.
You don't sound very, very sure of that.
I've not been trying it too often. I did.
There's a lot of patience involved,
yes,
in getting rid of things via organic methods.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
You know,
it teaches you patience.
Improvement can take much longer than most of us would probably want to wait.
Right. Joe is calling us from Glen Burnie. Joe, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got a question. I've got some coffee trees, a coffee plant. They're very small. I got them about a year ago. I didn't understand that the six or seven little stems that came out of the container were actually each a tree. So they sat there for a year, and when I transplanted them, the roots were pretty tangled. I lost several. So I got about eight of them that are sitting there. They're green. They look good, but they're not sending up new leaves. And I was wondering if you have any idea what fertilizer to use. They're about 8 inches tall right now.
Coffee plants, 8 inches. Joe, thank you for the question. Anybody have any insights into coffee plants?
No, I've never tried a coffee plant. I don't know. I guess if it's not putting out new growth, then I would say nitrogen is probably needed. So a fertilizer that's high in nitrogen.
Okay.
But it's also a fruit-bearing plant, I assume, in this area. I don't know.
So where would you suggest Joe get an answer to his question?
You can go online. The University of Maryland Extension has the Home Garden Information Center. And that is this whole office in Ellicott City, Maryland, where the State Master Gardener Coordinator works, and in a whole office of folks. And they have horticulturalists, botanists, entomologists, all this network that if you send them a message on the Ask a Master Gardener blurb or Ask an Expert, that can then be answered. So if you send it out via that network.
So you can tap online into all this wisdom.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
They're real people. They're not.
And this is an Ask the Master Gardener link on the University of Maryland.
Or Ask an Expert.
Ask an Expert.
Yes.
On the University of Maryland Extension.
Yeah.
Webpage.
Home Garden Information Center. Yeah.
Home Garden Information
H-G-I-C.
Center. We will link to that, Joe. I appreciate your bringing that to our attention. Kimmy from Harvard of Grace says she has a solution to the thistle problem. Kimmy, what is the answer?
Do tell.
Well, I have been attempting to go organic myself, and there's a meme that pops up on Facebook all the time, and I thought one night I would give it a go. It's you pour boiling water over the plants, and in the time that you spend spraying herbicides, you can spend, I have an old electric kettle that I just plug in as I'm doing it, and it go along and pour boiling water on it, and you can also use vinegar just on the plants. You know, like I said, the time you spend spraying one herbicide, spray vinegar instead, and it does go to the root system.
Kimmy, thank you for that suggestion. Does it sound plausible?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people use vinegar, especially for getting weeds out of cracks, you know, like in a patio and that kind of thing. You can kind of knock
them down.
It's highly
acidic.
Highly acidic. So
yes.
That's the problem. You know, you could alter the pH of the soil.
I presume in that particular spot you would be altering the pH. I promised we would get back to tomatoes, which we talked about very briefly. What are the biggest pitfalls? And first of all, is it too late right now to plant tomatoes?
No.
How much time do people have to get themselves organized to do that and expect harvest this summer?
I was actually at a elementary school this morning putting tomatoes in garden planters with little preschool students. You know, it's not too late to put tomatoes in the ground, especially if you're putting transplants in the ground. Really, people start from seed. They will start tomatoes inside in March. And that allows the tomato to get to this big, healthy stage that when you put it outside, it's vigorous, it's ready to go. And you can buy tomato seedlings from many different places at the farmer's market, at home and garden centers, anywhere.
Okay. What are your favorite varieties?
Well, I'm an heirloom advocate. They are indeterminate, which means that they will have a continual crop throughout the summer. They also will grow to a big size. So it's not always the ideal thing for a small area. But the heirloom plants, the heirloom vegetables tend to have higher nutritional value than those that have been cultivated for trait. You know, lots of our the hybrids, the hybrids. I dream about this time of year all year round, waiting for the real tomato to show up on the plant. But it's worth it. It's what I live for in the summer.
And what are the most common problems people encounter growing tomatoes, and can they head them off?
Blight.
What is blight?
Blight is, it's a soil-borne, I think it's soil-borne, is it?
I believe so,
yeah. You would know the soil stuff. It's soil-borne, and it generally develops. There's early blight and late blight, and they sometimes develop because there's not enough circulation around the plant. And you can generally control it by removing the leaves at the bottom turn yellow.
Exactly.
And if you pull those off, you can generally control it.
Even before those leaves turn yellow, there are many gardeners who, preemptively will take the lower four sets of leaves off their tomato plant. What is, you know, once it's grown to a large enough size that it can still support itself and photosynthesize once those leaves are gone. And that is definitely one way of, you know.
So preemptively taking taking those lowers up. We have a bunch of queries and only a couple of minutes left, so let me see whether I can cram a few of these in. Elizabeth has emailed us. She says, I live in the middle of Towson, literally in the middle, and yet I have deer in my yard. How can this be, and what's the most effective way to get rid of them? Advice for Elizabeth.
I say fences.
Fences.
Yeah,
fences.
Putting a fence, a deer fence, up around your garden that is at least 8 to 10 feet tall.
8 to 10 feet?
Yes, deer can jump. Absolutely. I know that some people don't think that that is the most aesthetically pleasing thing, but that is the easiest way to keep deer out of your garden.
Out of your garden.
Yep.
You have to fence any new woody plant that you plant, like trees and shrubs. You need to protect them. The trees especially, it's not so much that the deer eat it, but they rub it, and that then disturbs the bark and then prevents the tree from doing its thing.
We have just a couple minutes left. John from Boonesboro, can you pose your question quickly?
Hello?
Hello, John. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm a commercial grower at Kensho Farms, and I'm using Weed Guard Plus paper this year for the first time. Do you have any experience with it for controlling weeds and any idea how it performs?
John, thanks for the question. Do either of you have an answer for John?
I've not used that particular brand.
I've not used. I use newspaper all the time. About 4 to 6 sheets of newspaper. I wet it. In fact, we put in a garden. I just moved to Towson with all the deer, and we put in a garden this year at my home. And we did not till. We laid cardboard over the places where we wanted beds, and then covered that with a mix of topsoil and compost. And we in a month and a half, we could plant right in it. So the cardboard started to disintegrate, and there's minimal weeds. And I'm a big smotherer.
That is lasagna.
Yeah, lasagna gardening.
People will also use landscape fabric, too. And I think that's probably what John is talking about. It's kind of like this this plastic, almost woven mulch. And I have used that and found quite a bit of success with it by cutting holes into the
fabric
and
planting
holes
into
it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We have almost no time left. In 30 seconds, can you tell me what people should know about planting flowers for the benefit of their food crops?
We always suggest that you plant something that's going to attract pollinators to your vegetable garden. It makes it look pretty anyway. I don't know what else to say.
It's we very have covered decorative. A lot of territory, and we're going to link to some of these resources, and we should do this again sometime. Oh. I really have enjoyed talking to you. Erin Melantine, Master Gardener Coordinator at the University of Maryland Extension. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Patricia Foster, Master Gardener for the University of Maryland Extension's Baltimore City Office, Executive Director of the Silburn Arboretum Association. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm glad you got here. Also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Tens of thousands of people are on waiting lists for life-saving organ transplants from donors. And more than 500,000 bone grafts are performed every year. What if we could just build organs and bones for these patients? One day, we may be able to do that with the help of 3D printers. That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Kast.